This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Ozempic and other GLP-1 medications are changing people's relationships with the foods they eat. What does that mean for the food and beverage industry, and for everyone who isn't taking GLP-1 drugs? Joining me now to discuss this are Ohio State University Food Science and Technology Professor Martha Bullery. Thanks so much for being here, Professor Bullery.
Happy to be joining you today.
University of Cincinnati University of Cincinnati Endowed Professor of Psychiatry and Neuroscience, Dr. Susan McElroy. Thanks for being here, Dr. McElroy.
Thank you for inviting me.
And Christ Hospital Network endocrinologist, Dr. Jennifer Whitwer. Thanks for being here, Dr. Whitwer.
I appreciate the invitation as well.
UC is a financial supporter of Cincinnati Public Radio. Dr. Whitwer, how do these drugs, these GLP-1 drugs, work? What impact do they have on how much people eat?
So these medications, they are in a class of medications called incretin mimetics. And incretins are gut hormones that stimulate the internal or endocrine secretion from pancreatic beta cells. And the concept of these following nutrient ingestion after food intake is not new. This has actually been discovered back in the 1900s, and the term incretin was coined in the 1930s. And these medications stimulate after food ingestion the rate of nutrient flow through the gastrointestinal system, as well as signaling to the brain that we've received nutrients and they direct appetite.
How broadly are these drugs being used in the United States, Dr. Whitwer?
So more and more, they are becoming much more popular. So there's been a 1.7% increase in compared to 2 years ago in utility overall of these particular medications, but that continues to rise. In fact, there are 8 to 10 medications very similar to the ones that are presently on the market going through FDA approval now. So they are gaining popularity very quickly.
Dr. McElroy, I understand you've studied the effects these drugs can have on people with binge eating disorder. Tell us what you found there.
I tried very hard to do that, but was unable to get what's called an investigator-initiated trial from any of the companies making these compounds to look at binge eating disorder using the highest standards. So what I did, me and my colleagues, we did a study of liraglutide, the sort of the semaglutide precursor, to people with bipolar disorder who were stable and who were had overweight or obesity. It took us 7 years to complete. And basically what we found is that these drugs definitely significantly reduced weight without worsening the bipolar disorder. And that's a really important topic we can come back to later. But moreover, we had just a general measure of binge eating, and there was a significant reduction in binge eating as well. Bipolar disorder and binge eating are closely related.
Tell us a little bit more about that. Why was that a concern, that reducing weight could somehow aggravate bipolar disorder?
Okay, that is an excellent question. We have now learned that obesity is related to a number of mental disorders. I think it's an understudied area. You know, there are a few mental disorders associated with underweight, you know, anorexia, substance abuse, but most are associated with overweight, and we really don't understand that. So bipolar disorder is one of the disorders that is most strongly associated with overweight and obesity. And sometimes we just think it's because the medications we use to stabilize the illness, stimulate appetite, and that's definitely a part of the problem. But what our group has found is that there's also a relationship between bipolar disorder and eating disorders, particularly binge eating disorder. And binge eating disorder is the most common eating disorder. And unlike the other eating disorders, it is strongly associated with obesity.
Professor Bulleri, what are the implications of these drugs that are becoming so much more popular for food and beverage companies? Do you anticipate major shifts in their businesses?
Yeah, we know that people on GLP-1 inhibitors or agonists need to actually make sure they eat enough calories to provide sufficient nutrition in their diets. There can be so many effects of the incretin effect that Dr. Whitwer mentioned, as well as the slowed digestion and slower gastric emptying, to make people feel like they're fed and full, that they don't eat enough calories. And so food companies are considering ways to provide their current products and maybe develop new products that deliver nutrient-dense foods, that meaning a lot of nutrition in per calorie that you're consuming, and then also perhaps packaging foods with smaller serving sizes, because many people can't eat what we consider a full serving of, for instance, a protein and a vegetable and a starch.
And that packaging in the smaller portion sizes, is that in response to consumer trends these companies are already seeing, or do you think it's in anticipation that those trends are coming as more and more people take these medications?
Good question, and probably both. I have seen some numbers, and I don't know where I read this, but it could be that a large section of our or segment of our population of adults could be on these drugs in the future. I'm not sure if one of our other guests today have the numbers, but I've heard something like 10% of adults in the United States could be prescribed these drugs at one point or another. And that's a large portion, of course, of people who are purchasing and consuming foods.
We're talking about what impact Ozempic and other medications like it are having on the food and beverage industry. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Dr. Whitwer, I understand these drugs can also have gastric side effects. What are those side effects?
As these medications mimic gut hormones, it can cause a variety of issues with the gastrointestinal system, including nausea, vomiting, upset stomach, diarrhea, constipation. So, a whole constellation of symptoms. Not only does it cause problems with the actual gut itself, but because these medications can stimulate weight change, they can cause problems with the gallbladder and rarely issues with the pancreas. A condition called pancreatitis can develop after these medications as well.
Professor Bulleri, are food companies addressing those side effects and some of what they're working on also?
I haven't learned as much about food companies addressing those. I would say that what is also important for helping consumers choose foods is working with a personalized dietitian, so a registered dietitian who can really help them find foods that will hopefully prevent some of these gastrointestinal side effects, as well as help them maintain the proper calorie intake that's going to provide adequate nutrition. One of the things many dietitians recommend as a broad kind of blanket recommendation is to eat smaller meals throughout the day. But again, many patients just aren't hungry through the day. So personalized dietetics and nutrition is going to have to be a key part of this as well.
Dr. Whitmer, I want to get your thoughts on this, and I'll also ask you, Professor Bulleri. I understand some companies you mentioned are Professor Bulleri, are working to create these more nutrient-dense foods, maybe with higher protein levels and that sort of thing, to appeal to people who are eating less, but they want to eat healthy. I guess I'm wondering, how healthy are these processed foods, really? I understand Nestle and Coca-Cola are getting into the game on this. Professor Bulleri, what are your thoughts? I mean, are these foods actually going to be nutritious?
So I'm of the opinion that foods are complicated, and when we try to classify foods as processed or ultra-processed, we really need to dig down deeper and know what we're talking about. So there have been approaches to categorize foods, for instance, as ultra-processed, and I think it's defined by a couple of different things, but one is the number of ingredients in a food. I should have looked this up before the interview today, but I think it's something like five ingredients or more could be defined as processed, regardless of what the definition is. And there are several out there, by the way, that scientists are trying to develop algorithms to predict healthiness for. Many foods that we would define as processed in these categorizations that the scientists and clinicians are coming up with might not really be unhealthy. In fact, we know many are very healthy and have an important place in our food supply. I would use the example of infant formula and supplemental foods for people who are dealing with appetite problems or something else. We know these foods have an important role in helping people achieve health. So I find it kind of, I try to discourage people from looking at ultra processed and processed foods as harmful. In fact, there's not really a black and white way to categorize most foods because they're complicated.
A lot of gray area. What if I know some people who say, if I can't pronounce the ingredients, I'm not eating it. Is that an indicator you should look at, Professor Baluri?
Again, even some of our vitamins and minerals, but especially vitamins, have names that many people can't pronounce. So again, I say, and this is my dietitian hat. I'm also the department chair of food science and technology at Ohio State University. But in both worlds, I try to make sure people know it's a little more complicated than something like a simple rule like that.
Dr. Whitwer, I want to get your thoughts on that too. When you're talking with patients who are taking these drugs, they're eating less, but they want to make sure they're, getting the nutrients they need. What are your thoughts on some of these processed foods that some of these companies are working on?
So I have to agree with Dr. Baluri as well that not all processed foods are the same. For example, some foods that we typically regard as ultra processed, like potato chips, are no more extensively processed than something like olive oil or dark chocolate, which we typically consider very healthy foods. Other ultra processed foods that you want to pay attention to are those served in large portions that are highly palatable, energy dense, contain high amounts of refined sugar, or have a high glycemic load or glycemic index, have a lot of salt, poor quality of protein or fat, that are low in micronutrients and low fiber. Those types of ultra processed foods have probably created this problem in the first place. These types of foods are characteristic to leading to poor health outcomes, such as metabolic abnormalities like insulin resistance, excess adiposity, high cholesterol, and high blood pressure. With those on GLP-1 medications, excuse me, or incretin mimetics, there's no one size fits all when it comes to nutrition. So I agree that personalized nutrition programs can be very beneficial for most people on these medications, like any other adult. I typically do recommend simple, nutritious foods. So choose foods that have few ingredients, or whole foods. You also want to maintain a good balance of nutrients. Mix up colorful vegetables and fruit. Eat a variety of lean proteins and whole grains, and then consume a small amount of healthy fat. Fat is very difficult for the stomach to digest. So when you're on these medications, it's delaying how quickly food's leaving your stomach. And so if it's already hard for the stomach to digest and break down that material, it can be really rough and lead to some of those gastrointestinal side effects I had previously talked about.
When you're talking about some of the foods that maybe led to some of these problems in the first place, are you talking about the chips aisle, the cookies aisle? I mean, the aisles that so many parents just avoid completely in the grocery store with their children? Are those the kinds of foods you're talking about?
So foods that are easily absorbed and that we can eat a large amount of, they cause an overload of nutrients. So for example, if you eat something like a piece of white bread, it's going to be processed differently than something like a multi-grain sourdough bread. And so that white bread, it's already been refined and broken down, and so it can be more easily absorbed and have a higher glycemic load. And so your body gets a rush of nutrients all at once, and it has to be processed a little bit differently. glucose is like the gold of the body. It's what our body prefers to run on. And so our body just doesn't get rid of glucose, it stores it. So if we have a large influx of glucose all at once, that is going to go into storage rather than utilized over a small period of time. Also, things that are complex carbohydrates, fruits and vegetables, that kind of thing, they contain insoluble fibers that make it all the way through our small intestines. And we have L cells in the very low part of our small intestines, which are responsible for releasing GLP-1 naturally. So if you don't have nutrients making it all the way through your system to release those hormones appropriately, that can cause issues as well.
Dr. McElroy, I want to talk to you about what you've found in your work with patients and some of the studies that you've done. What do you think, to what degree has Ozempic and these other drugs, to what degree have they changed our relationship with food and led to healthier decisions? I wonder if these GLP-1 friendly products will appeal to people, or you know, how has that really changed in your view, the way people look at food?
Well, I really can't speak to that. I have not been able to get a company that makes a GLP-1 support a study of one of these compounds in eating disorders. So it's just incredibly important to remember that people with eating disorders are very different than people without them.
Talk about the relationship to food that people with eating disorders have and how that is different.
It's exaggerated. It's people with an eating disorder are obsessed with food. They have all this noise in their head that's related to the eating disorder. Some people restrict. That means they don't eat enough. Some people binge, they eat too much. And then there's some people who binge and purge. And then we're discovering yet other forms of eating disorders. So I'm just really sad that the GLP-1 companies haven't taken eating disorders seriously. Because just a couple things. And I can only speak, I'm speaking of clinical experience. So I've seen GLP-1s trigger anorexia, just like any other weight loss drug can do in somebody who has a tendency to that. I've seen these drugs work beautifully in people with binge eating disorder, including those who have failed everything. Patients tell me it just ceases all the eating disorder talk in my head. And I think that's all I can really say, because the industry has basically ignored eating disorders. I guess they assume that by getting obesity, they're going to get most of the people with eating disorders, but that's just not the truth.
Professor Bellery, most of us aren't taking these GLP-1 drugs. What kind of impact could these changes in the food and beverage industry, as companies look to make these changes, what kind of impact could those have for the rest of the population?
You know, I really liked what we heard from Dr. Whitwer about some of the broad dietary guidelines that we have in our country, which our government every 5 years comes up with the dietary guidelines. And we know less than 40% of adults follow these to any degree close to being even 80% on target, meaning, okay, most of our population isn't even meeting 50% of the recommendations on a daily basis. And these are just broad ones. And so if we look at our general population, either people trying to prevent weight gain, further weight gain and all, or control their weights, or even reduce weights, the best way to do it still is moderately, so that you maintain your muscle mass, which keeps your metabolism rate up, as well as muscle mass predicts for a lot of other health outcomes, physical activity, modest calorie lowering, so that you have less calories in than you're burning. And it takes a while, but that's the problem, is it takes a while, whereas these GLP-1 drugs really seem to kind of boost weight loss, which is very exciting for many people who've struggled with body weight problems. But then, and then we have the long-term consequences. And so, well, how the food industry could be influencing this, I always think of the food industry as both responsive and driving how people consume food, of course, and then how food companies respond to that. So I think changing serving sizes, providing even for people ideas and concepts, but even foods that can be packaged in a way that can be stable over a day if you're sending these, if you're taking these foods to work or to a place where you don't have adequate refrigeration, as actually some of our population even has at home, lack of adequate refrigeration for preserving their foods. Some of these foods might really be beneficial in those areas. We know many adults struggle with obesity in this country. And so I really think, in general, talking more about how, whether it's GLP-1 drugs are affecting food and diet quality in our country, as well as how diet quality and foods can be influencing how to manage GLP-1 drugs, is important and will continue to be.
Dr. Whitwer, we just heard Professor Bellery talk about the long-term implications of taking these GLP-1 drugs. I don't know if you've got any patients who've been taking them long enough for you to have thoughts on what those long-term implications could be, but have you seen that? What are some of the long-term effects of taking these drugs? Because you can't just lose the weight and stop, right? This is something you have to continue.
For the most part, we do believe these will be maintenance medications, medications that people will be on for a long period of time. The data we have at present is typically from those who have history of diabetes. This class of medications has been prescribed for patients with diabetes since the early 2000s. So we do have some long-term data on some of the earlier versions of these medications, geared towards people who have diabetes and know that they are safe over that long period of time. However, for weight change, we don't have a lot of long-term data, only because these medications have not been around for very long, about 4 to 5 years for the most part. We are learning that people do lose a little bit of their muscle mass, and I am very much an advocate of exercise and making sure muscle mass is maintained. As Dr. Bollery said, there are a lot of health benefits from having a good amount of muscle mass and making sure that you're mobile and exercising. We do suspect, though, that there will be long-term implications regarding bone health. Anytime there is a significant amount of weight change, we can have issues with our bone health. There are side effects from weight change in and of itself. For example, people can have changes in hair growth, they can have gallbladder issues, and those are all popping up with these medications as well.
And Dr. Whitwer, you spoke to this a little bit before, but if as we're looking for food, that's healthy, that meets our needs, whether we're on these drugs or not, what should we all be looking for in food packaging to make sure it's healthy and providing the nutrients that we need, that our families need every day?
So, using the food label can be a very helpful choice. Choosing foods that do not have any trans fat or low in saturated fat can be particularly helpful. Looking at carbohydrates and dietary fiber, fiber is a very important nutrient for us. Protein content can also be helpful. And then looking at the vitamins and minerals that food provides is also very helpful. Eating whole foods is always a great option. They tend to be packed full of nutrients, lots of fiber, and those can be helpful options in regards to making sure you have a more healthful diet.
Anything you want to add to that, Professor Bullery, in the 30 seconds or so we have left?
No, well said.
Well, great. Well, I've been talking with Ohio State University Department of Food Science and Technology Professor Martha Bullery, University of Cincinnati Endowed Professor of Psychiatry and Neuroscience Dr. Susan McElroy, and endocrinologist with the Christ Hospital Network Dr. Jennifer Whitwer. Thank you all so much for your time today. It was a terrific conversation. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director today is Ella Rowan. If you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thank you so much for listening.